Good evening. Tonight, in our discussion of Games of Strategy, the Paul Owen and Dr. Witt's Colloquium on Games of Strategy, we will be talking about game trees and sequential games. We have tonight Paul Owen, of course.
Good evening.
Austin from Dr. Witt's.
Hello, interwebs.
And Aaron from Dr. Witt's, coming to you live from Baltimore, all together at Unpub 7.
Woo!
Yeah.
Great.
No other woos?
No?
Okay. So this episode's chapter is dealing with sequential moves.
Yeah, the book that we've been looking at, The Games of Strategy, chapter 3 addresses what they call sequential games, games in which each decision that somebody makes is in the knowledge of the decisions that have come before. And so we can describe a sequential game in the form of a network of decision points. Each point is when a person, or in some cases an external entity, chooses one of several paths. And then downstream of that path comes another decision point, another node, where that same player or another player or another external entity makes another decision and chooses among one of several paths.
So if we did this like a simplified version of that, let's imagine I'm choosing to go buy ice cream, so I'm making a decision, and whether or not I choose to go buy an ice cream is going to affect Austin's decision, whether he chooses to go buy ice cream. But he's making his decision after I've made my initial decision.
And with the knowledge of the fact that you made that decision. So that's what constitutes kind of the essence of a sequential game. Sequential game is said to begin at an initial node, so there's a known starting game state.
So in that example, my decision would be the initial node.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And since there's only two decisions being made, after I've made my decision, which would be a branch, because I have two branches.
Right.
I either buy ice cream or I don't.
Right.
Then Austin would get to choose whether he buys ice cream or not, and that's his initial node after I've made my choice.
And the interesting thing about that example is, so two branches emerge from your initial node. There is the I decide to buy ice cream and the I decide not to buy ice cream. And at the end of each of those branches is a decision node for Austin. So there's really two. Austin has two decision nodes, but only one of them will he actually exercise a decision, depending on what you did.
Right. And what you don't realize is that while I might want ice cream, I have a third option. I get to flip a coin to make the decision for me if I want to make it. Want to get ice cream.
Oh, you're making this
so
more
now
complicated.
I'm going to make this really complicated.
Don't do that yet. I don't think our audience is ready for that
I'm
yet.
Two-faced.
No, don't do that yet. I mean, I think people may want to know that even though that you're right, there's only going to be two options available for Austin based on what I've done, we could map out all four options for Austin. That'd be all of the pure strategy possibilities.
Right. Right. That's kind of where I was headed. And then the result of that is Austin has a total of essentially four branches coming from his decisions. And in the case you've elaborated, there's no further decisions to be made. So each of those would end at a terminal node, and each terminal node would have some payoff for you and for Austin, assuming that you're the only players in the game.
And this will allow the players to see how their behavior affects each other. So for Austin, he knows that if I go get ice cream, he can see what his payoff is going to be for getting ice cream and not getting ice cream, and he will choose the one that gives him the highest payout.
Right.
Which is usually getting ice cream, regardless of what he chose. But
and this is leading to rollback solutions.
Right.
I can look at what decisions Austin's going to make, depending on whether or not I'm going to get ice cream or not get ice cream, and depending on which set of decisions work out best. My case, avoiding wherever Austin's going to be at, it will decide.
Generally, a good idea.
Decide where whether I choose to get ice cream or not. So if he's going to get ice cream no matter what I do, I'm going to elect not to get ice cream based on what Austin's going to do.
And that's a good point too. So your knowledge of the way the game tree lays out, what Austin's payoffs are and what your payoffs are for each of those cases, allows you to do that rollback analysis. You can work backwards for each of his decision nodes and say, okay, in that case, he'll choose to get ice cream. In this other case, he'll also choose to get ice cream. So then you can the rollback analysis would essentially say, I'm going to prune from the game tree. I'm going to remove those branches for decisions that I know Austin's not going
to
make.
Because if we were actually to draw these decisions out, it would look like a Christmas tree almost.
Right, right. Sort of a continually branching out network.
Except when we prune it, we'd prune at the base first and go up.
Okay. But now that simplifies essentially your decision case to, you know that if you take the decision to get ice cream, you know what the payoff will be because you know what Austin will do. And you know if you don't have ice cream, what the payoff will be because you know what Austin will do. And now you can choose the branch that gives you the higher payoff.
Because at that point, there's just one continuous path for
right.
my first decision.
And so essentially, we've done rollback analysis on this particular game that we've described, right? And so we know what's going to happen. We know what your best strategy
is.
Aaron's
going to stay home alone.
And we know
I'm going to go out and get ice cream.
Exactly.
And
yes.
We're both happy.
And you're both happy.
It's great.
Well, we're always as happy as we're going to be.
Under the circumstances of the game, right?
Exactly.
Right. So we've essentially described a game tree. We've described rollback analysis. One thing we sort of glossed over was the fact that there can be decision nodes that don't involve the players themselves.
Yeah, I want to get back to my coin flip.
Yeah, yeah. So let's take that case now. So you can have a decision node where something happens outside the control of the players that can result in one of several branches. And the coin flip is an example. The node is the decider, I guess, is the coin, or it can be called random event or nature or whatever.
What they, and I find it is interesting in the book, what they use is the word nature.
Yes.
To describe every sort of external event.
Right, right.
That could possibly happen.
As a board game designer, I call it dice.
Sure.
Chit pull.
Okay. Yes. Cards.
Or card cards. Shuffle, yes. Exactly. Or whatever randomizing element. Spinner, yes.
Small children.
So in the case that Austin describes, after Aaron's decision, you can have a node for a coin flip, and then, whether it's heads or tails, then a decision node for Austin, whether he chooses to get ice cream or not.
Now, I noticed that this can later be combined with simultaneous games, but we're not doing that today.
Right.
But we are prefacing that this is a possibility. Just our focus today is purely on sequential games.
Right.
We will get to simultaneous games in a later future episode.
And at a later point, simultaneous games with sequential games.
Right.
One more bit of terminology that's worth going over. So we mentioned that making a choice at a single node, that's called a move. And then having a plan of action that governs what your moves are going to be over the complete map of the game tree is called a strategy. So it's interesting, and this is what I found I struggled with a little bit at this part of the book, where he said, even if you've done some rollback analysis and evaluated that there are certain decision nodes that you're never going to get to because of decisions you will have made earlier in the game, a complete strategy still governs what you would do if you were at that decision point in order to be a complete strategy. I'm not sure why that was necessary, but he sort of hints that that will become important later.
Right. I guess it's just the idea that you, even once you've mapped it out, you shouldn't be really changing. If you're changing your strategy while you're playing the game, then you haven't actually created a complete strategy.
Right.
So,
right. Right.
You can't call it that. You can't call it a complete strategy if you keep making stuff up as you go. Paul, I think you wanted to get into the consequences of having these game trees.
Sure, right. So in the case of a simple game, right, being able to map out a game tree, being able to do rollback analysis, you can evaluate how the game's going to turn out. Now, of course, if you have a game that's too complex, you get to the point where you can't do that anymore. But what's interesting is, we can go into a sequential version of the Battle of the Sexes and talk about how that would work.
Well, what is the game of the Battle of the Sexes?
So the game of the Battle of the Sexes poses a situation to a married couple. What do they want to do this evening? You know, for what social event do they want to go to? The wife prefers opera, but the husband prefers bullfighting was the one that I read. But each of them prefers to go to an event with their spouse over going to an event alone, in any case. Oh, and also the construct of the game is that the wife that makes a decision first where she wants to go, and knowing that, then the husband makes a decision. So the way the game plays out, if the wife has chosen the opera. The husband will choose the opera because he'd prefer to be with the wife than be at the bullfight alone. If the wife chooses the bullfight, the husband will choose the bullfight because he'd prefer to be with the wife rather than go to the opera alone. The wife, knowing that, does the rollback analysis and says, oh, well, if I choose opera, we get to go to the opera. That's my favorite thing of all. And so she chooses opera, and therefore the husband says, well, I guess I'll go to the opera. And so they end up with a payoff of the wife's maximum possible payoff, and then the husband's, well, it's not as bad as being alone. I'll go to the opera payoff, right? The interesting thing about that is, talking about consequences, in this particular game, there's what's called a first mover advantage, right? The person who goes first gets to choose a path that results in their maximum possible payoff. The other players have to settle for whatever payoff they can get in that situation.
In essence, going first means you win.
In a sense, yes, right, right. Assuming that it's competitive, and in this case it isn't necessarily competitive, depending on how you look at it.
As we would say in game theory, it's a non-zero-sum game.
A non-zero-sum game, exactly, yes, right. So we're talking about consequences. I mean, is it worth getting into kind of some of the shortcomings of rollback analysis like we were...
And I mean, the only other question is, what if the husband comes home, kicks down the door, is like, honey, I'm home, we're going to the bullfight tonight.
Yes, right, right.
It's so this happening goes... today, we're going to go.
Well, okay, but I don't know if that's the best example, because in essence, he just became the first mover.
Right.
After a fashion, right. So then if you consider signaling to be a move, then yes.
But is signaling, because we started talking about this last episode,
right.
Would that be a signal, or would the signaling only come in if the couple started arguing about what they wanted to do?
It's a signal. The question is it a credible signal?
Right, right.
So what does he have that says he is fully committed to going to the bullfight? Does he have bullfight tickets already? Hey, honey, look what I have. Does he have, I'm sorry, honey, I've been banned from the theater. They threw me out for something I did there the other night.
Right, right, right. Right, so this goes to, right, so signaling, of course, is giving information in a way that intended to manipulate the decisions of the other players, or to elicit information. No, it's really to give her information, right?
Well, it is to clearly communicate an action that you're going to do.
Right. And so in the rollback analysis, right, the wife is now faced with a situation of thinking, well, no matter what I pick, the husband will choose the bullfight.
And because that signal is credible, it now alters the behavior of the other player. So you're seeing the signaling being effective when it alters the behavior of the other players in a way that's closer aligned to the preference of the player providing the signal.
Now, even though in this example, she still gets to go, she still makes the first move. Well, that's what we're saying, because the important part is that she still has to make the first move, but he has to make the signal and still go second. That's the tricky part here.
Well, it's almost as if, this is a tough part, is he really still going second, or by committing the signal did he just become the new first mover?
That sort of implies that we've reconstructed the game tree. We've put a decision node before the wife's decision. That's the husband has a decision of what signal to make before the wife's decision.
Well, it turns the game into no longer about, the game becomes who can get home first to make the first credible signal. And if you both make credible signals that you're going to your event, no one is going to an event together. I got myself thrown out of the theater for punching the orchestra leader's face, and my wife
already bought tickets. And well,
yeah. even worse. My wife joined PETA and tried organizing a protest at the event,
right.
and they threw her out for that. So she's been banned from the arena.
Right. So in any case, that's a situation where yes, by signaling you can affect the rollback analysis. Therefore, like you say, affect the wife's decision and result in the advantage going to the, I guess, the first signaler or to the husband or whatever.
Well, Paul, you had a different example, though. We can kind of get out of this little infinite
right.
rollback of
yes.
First player, first move,
right,
push.
Right, right.
I put my hand on top of yours, you put your hand on my top.
So let's talk about the what's called the ultimatum game. That's a situation where
That almost sounds like the same thing we were just talking about.
It's sort of an ultimatum, right. So suppose I am given an offer. I'm offered $100, right? And I'm playing with Austin, and the deal that I get is you make Austin an offer of part of that $100. If Austin accepts, he gets to keep his portion, you get to keep yours. If Austin rejects, then neither of you gets anything. So I look at, essentially, I have 100 decisions, 100 branches off my tree. And then Austin has 2 branches off of each of his decision points. In all cases, Austin's decision is accept or reject. And if he rejects, he gets 0. And if he accepts, he gets something. So in all cases, my rollback evaluation is Austin should accept whatever offer I give him. Therefore, I offer Austin $1. Austin, needing $1, says yes, and I get to keep 99. That's what rollback analysis would say.
You think.
And keeping it simple, this would be like a one-off game. You're not playing this game over and over again with Austin.
Very good point. It's not like we're going to do this over and over again, or I'm going to do it with 100 other people or anything else. It's just a one-time offer.
So do you have the money on you now?
I haven't been made the offer yet.
All right. Okay.
All right.
But in practice, in terms of social experimentation, empirically, that's not the way human beings behave. In fact, the general results are that, first of all, the player A will tend to offer something closer to a 50-50 deal, even though it's not in their best interest to do so. And if they don't, in general, player B will reject offers that are less than between, say, 25 and 40% of the total available. So if you offer me less than $25 to $40, then I'm just going to reject it, even though I'm walking away from $25 to $40. The social analysis seems to suggest that there's a perception of fairness that comes into play, both for player A, who thinks, well, it's not fair for me to just keep 99 and offer $1, and for player B, who thinks, well, he's being unfair to me, and I'm not going to accept an unfair deal.
Well, and then from my understanding, there's also research out there that suggests that this ratio can change from country to country and culture to culture.
Right, right. Also, the results change. The players don't know, or the second player doesn't know, who decided how much of a cut they were going to get. So, for example, if Austin is told, Paul's been offered some money and you get $25 of it, or you get $1, would you accept that dollar?
Sure.
Sure. Well, I get $1. Why not? You don't think of it, you don't perceive it as Paul's being unfair to me by only offering me $1. And in that case, people tend to accept a lot. The results tend to be much more in line with a rollback analysis.
Now, let's highlight that so we're really clear why that is such a dilemma for game theory. You know, when we do game theory, as we said last time, the payouts tell us the story. Your decisions when you trim the tree are just based on the payouts. And we're describing a situation where people are not following the payouts. One argument might be, well, are the payouts really representing the preferences of the people?
Right.
You're using dollar amounts here, and we're assuming that the desire for money outweighs the desire for an idea of fairness.
And the only factor that goes into the payout is just the money, when in fact, this research would suggest that there are multiple other factors coming into play.
And that hits on a potential limitation of game theory, particularly for a game designer in a board game setting. We're using this model.
Victory points.
Victory points.
All you care about is victory points. But that's not really true, is it?
Right.
we're seeing even research in game theory confirming what we have seen when we've played board games, of people not following the strict payouts.
And so, you kind of have to make sure that if you're going to try to describe a game in a game tree and try to predict the behavior or establish the correct strategy, you need the payouts to reflect what people's actual valuations are.
Or you rely on what they say early on in this book, which is game theory may not always tell you what is the right thing to do, but it sure as darn going to tell you what's a dumb thing to do.
Right, right. So I was thinking about this notion of fairness in the context, going back to the Battle of the Sexes thing, which is, if this is a game that they play every week,
mm-hmm.
and if we played it strictly by game theory, then they would go to the opera every week. But in practice, I think what we know would happen with a typical married couple, out of a sense of fairness, is either the wife would give the husband the first choice, or the wife would simply choose the bullfight. which is not what game theory would predict, but...
But then again, that's a little difference because that's a multiple game.
Good point.
Game where you play the game multiple times, right, as opposed to just once.
And if we're doing repeat interaction, mm-hmm, then we'd have to start factoring some other variables that could explain a different story in a mathematically reasonable manner.
I.e. maximum benefit for both parties over a stretch of time, as opposed,
sure,
to maximum benefit over, you know, individually for the one.
That's right, winning every game. Yeah.
Well, particularly if the participants get into this whole tit for tat sort of situation.
Right.
Because now they're using that to drive the long-term results, which could potentially produce a higher expected value for the husband than if he just always went with the pure strategy rollback solution.
But we will definitely be getting into that later.
Oh, yes.
In a future episode.
Oh, yes. Oh,
we're,
yes,
starting to peer into the future now, folks.
wait. I'm going to hold you guys back. Hold you back.
Yes, wait. We have to. Because there's
so many more ramifications just from the simple sequential version that we haven't hit upon yet. You know what the simple sequential version tells us as board game designers? What or not if we should play the game in the first place? If a game is solvable, why are we playing? Why am I playing this game over going to the opera or not going to the opera? I mean, I know I'm going to lose if I'm not going first. Why do I even bother playing? And that's true for any board game. I mean, who still plays tic-tac-toe other than for the amusement of a little child or out of pure boredom to see if someone makes a mistake? I mean, that at this point, that game is solvable. If you play it correctly, it will result in a tie. Having a solvable game can be a problem in of itself. So if that's the case, how do we make sequential games actually work as a board game, actually entertain? Because there are a lot of sequential games. In fact, I bet most games you play are sequential game. There is no simultaneous move in Agricola. There is no simultaneous move in Monopoly. There is no simultaneous move in Catan or Carcassonne. I mean, we can keep going on and on. Whether we talk about games that people in the community might despise today or games that people cherish, there's only a few games out there where we're not saying it's Paul's turn, then it's my turn, then it's Austin. So the question is, how do we make these games work in a fashion that people still want to play with each other and they still feel like they're actually engaging in some sort of competition of mind and wits versus, darn it, Paul, you're going first today, I'm going to lose. Or darn it, Austin, you're going second today, I'm going to lose. Also known as the second mover advantage.
Right.
You keep changing that number depending on which move will win the game. Third, right, mover, fourth mover, fifth mover, sixth mover.
And that's an interesting point, particularly in the context of games that have little or no luck, right? On the one hand, you can say, well, and maybe that goes to the answer to your question. Part of it is you keep a game interesting by having some random element in it. So poker, for example, part of what makes that game interesting, besides the bluffing and so forth, is simply the fact that you may draw the right hand at the right time.
And I was thinking something similar, because, I mean, I'm going to bring up Monopoly, because could you imagine playing Monopoly where you don't row and see if you buy a property, have the option to do it, or auction it? You actually got to say, I want to buy Park Place, and I'm going to buy Park Place. For Monopoly, once they start doing that, there's only so many purchasing combinations that can take place. We could probably draw up the game tree for that and work it out.
Right. And as you say, at that point, Monopoly would become a very uninteresting game.
Not that people listening to us already think it's not an uninteresting game, but...
Because right. No one would ever land on community. Well, we might still take community chess, but no one would ever land on luxury tax again.
Well, I didn't say pieces didn't move around to pay. I just focus on the idea of buying the property
buying
itself.
Properties in the first place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, essentially you'd be at the point where you'd say, okay, the solved game says that, Aaron, you're going to get Boardwalk in Pennsylvania and Illinois. Austin, you're going to get Park Place and whatever. And there would be a set optimum selection of properties, and we would just all go, okay, let's just start with that position and then go from there.
So one solution is just to randomize decisions so that if you drew out that game tree, then you would be saying, oh, I've been placed in this position, this is what I should do, but it's no longer predetermined where you're going to be. You're going to discover through the dice what your options are, and then based on your hand, start engaging in the trade and negotiation part of the game.
Which is why usually when I play, no real trades begin until after all, nearly all the properties are bought up in the first place.
Right.
Because you need to see where.
Another.
Did I just admit that I play Monopoly? I think I did.
I like Monopoly.
Oh, my.
I should say there are things I like about Monopoly. I'll put it that way.
Okay.
Another potential solution is just that there's so many moves in the game, you can't game it out.
Right, exactly. So if I take a more complex game, and chess is kind of the quintessential example.
I love the book. It quotes us the numbers. There are, I have it written down here, 10 to the power of 120 possibilities.
What's neat about that, it also went ahead and calculated how long it would take for a computer to map out all those possibilities, and it compared it to the lifetime of our sun, which is, I think, 10 to the 10th years. I just found that a really interesting number to have in my back pocket. If anything's longer than 10 to the 10th years, it's automatically not worth thinking about.
Granted, what year is your edition?
Let's see. I'll have to check. Yeah. But yeah, so clearly, well, not
that's
a
funny because my edition actually doesn't put it in terms of the length of time of the sun, puts it in length of time of the entire darn universe.
Oh, does it?
That it just comes in. the length of the universe is like 10 to the 120th, and to do chess was 10 to the 103. So,
and you have the second edition.
This is the second edition.
So I think we're seeing right now between the two books the updates.
The updates. As it goes on. Well, computers have gotten faster between.
Obviously, you can't map out the entire game of a game of chess. Now, you could, starting with a late game position with perhaps 6 pieces on the board. That's something you could map out in a game tree.
Well, and you get a lot of those games where you practice your end moves, I think for precisely that reason. How many moves can you get a checkmate in when there's these 5 pieces on the board or these specific 3 pieces on the board?
Right. Chess puzzles that pose, you know, white to mate in 3 and stuff like that are exactly, essentially cases of that, aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But how are you going to deal with the mid game? How are you going to deal with the beginning? If you don't have the ability to really gain those out, you have to use something else. In this book, they advocate for something that's known as a...
An intermediate value function? Is
yes.
That what you're thinking of?
Yes. It's a very mathematical sounding name, right?
It is, yes, right. It sounds like there should be a theorem associated with it.
There probably is, actually.
But yeah, so the idea of an intermediate value theorem is I have some way of evaluating my current position and the decisions that I have, the foreseeable decisions that I have and the consequences of those decisions. So if I'm looking at a situation where I can take an opponent's queen or I can take an opponent's rook, in a very short term, I might say, well, the decision to take the queen is a better decision because the queen's a more valuable piece, assuming that I value the queen more, right? But if I look out 2 or 3 or 4 moves in the future and I see, well, if I take the queen, then the rook will checkmate my king. Now my evaluation, my intermediate value evaluation is different.
Well, and the neat thing about this is since you're relying on this intermediate value function, it is possible that you could have competing intermediate value functions. Mm-hmm. And as people compete over it, one may trump be better than the other. And you can see like an evolution in intermediate value functions responding to better and better responses.
So if I hear you correctly, you're saying that as people, this I assume comes from repeated play. Where
sounds like knowledge and
right.
Known and experience with the game itself, you can start to better determine getting a better determination of those values of the intermediate.
Your intermediate value theorem functions, right. I was going to say theorem, right. So you modify your strategy. And here we use this term strategy a little bit, not in the sense of a complete strategy, but strategy in the sense of a rule that helps govern your decisions at various nodes.
Okay, so getting back to the major point, so how do you make sequential games interesting? So we talked about randomization is one way to do it.
Right.
Making the game just so, with so many nodes and so many branching paths that it's impossible to, that it's, while it's possible to create, find a solution, it's also very, extremely difficult, which I think most games would fall under that. And then is there any others that you can come up with, Aaron?
Well, yeah. A timer, in essence. Limit the ability to think it out. And I know you're very interested in this topic yourself, because this is a challenge for any sequential game. If there isn't a timer to force people to act, then what prevents them from not acting?
Right. I once had heard a casual gamer explain to a non-gamer what AP is. AP is analysis paralysis. So this casual gamer explains to the non-gamer that AP is when somebody is in a board game and faced with so many options that they freeze up and do nothing. Now, I mention this story because I find that to be an inaccurate way of talking about AP.
I'd agree.
Because in my mind, when you think about AP, AP is actually you looking at all the options available to you and then not being able to decide upon which path is the best path to take.
Yes.
So in your mind, you run down like three or four moves in advance going in one direction and you come up with a board state. And then you come back and then you run down three or four moves going with a different strategy. And then you run down again and you do something even crazier and crazier. So, and in your mind, you're keeping in your head the four or five different end state positions and you're trying to evaluate which one is actually better than the other.
Right.
And usually when you have a game with AP, I find that the big problem is that you are not able to assign values to any of those intermediate states. And so it is very difficult to decide on which path to take. And it gets even crazier in games where the players who are good seem to be good by doing really crazy things. And then you're like, oh no, is what I came up with crazy enough to actually win the game? Or get me on a path towards winning? I don't know.
This is not something you can solve by just giving someone a piece of paper and a pencil and say, draw the darn game tree.
Well,
not in a reasonable amount of time.
Not in a reasonable amount of time. And then even if, you know, I mean, even if there are, say, victory points attached to these things, because that's one way that can help. You're like, oh, if I do this, I'll get 5 victory points. If I do that, I'll get 6 victory points. But if it is a complex enough game, usually in, say, the beginning or mid-game, you know, in the mid-game section, getting a lot of victory points right now doesn't necessarily help you in the end state, towards the end state of the game. So usually these games, the games we now have nowadays have that trade-off. You're like, oh, I can get lots of victory points now, but then I don't have my engine built, so I can't actually exploit the massive amount of victory points I could gain some other way at the end of the game.
Right. You know, it's funny because as you were describing analysis process, I'm reminded of one of the ways that I most irritate my wife, which is usually the last round of Agricola, when I find that I have about 5 different ways to earn 2 points, and I can't decide which of those 5 different ways is the most optimum way to do so, especially if I'm already winning.
She's already done the math,
that's
Paul.
Right.
They're all the same result.
I have to make the rice. It's 7 o'clock. We're going to have a late dinner just to make a move and finish the game.
But isn't it always funny when it comes to those types of games, the games that slow down in the last 2 or 3 turns,
right,
just because everyone can finally see the end game and properly evaluate everything, and then the game just reaches to a halt?
Yes, yes.
And you
because
have to
you
wonder,
can evaluate the whole tree. Yes,
right, you now
before
can
you feel obligated to do so.
And before, it was just so far above your head that it's just like, oh, I guess I'll just do this.
I like sheep, I'll get some sheep, yeah.
Yeah, it was fine. And then it's like, oh, but now if I get those sheep, that's 5 points. But if I get the ore instead, that's...
Yes, exactly.
What that almost hits on a way game trees can be useful, and I think a problem with that game potentially. You know, at that point in the game, you might actually want it to be a very easy game tree to solve. I mean, game trees can be used within games as a way to not be the driver of the game, but you have a pre-planned response based on the situation players are in. So you can think of games where they give you choice, but the choice is obvious, but that choice is only obvious based on a particular situation. So if the situation changes, the obvious choice changes, and instead of just telling you to do it, they let you make that decision, just in case you have that knucklehead that wants to do something crazy.
So you remind me, like blackjack, for example, the decision to hit or not to hit changes depending on not just the cards that you have, but also the cards that the dealer has in terms of what's your optimum decision.
And then the same thing with the whole split, but I don't
know. Well, yes.
Yeah, I never got into that.
When do you split? Right.
When do you split?
So understanding game theory is definitely about, is my sequential game interesting at all? But it's also about, can I use this to simplify my life? Which I think you brought up a neat example of someone using it to simplify their life, realizing they didn't have to deal with all these issues. And that was the example you guys brought up from Survivor. That was in your edition of the book, but not my edition of the book.
Right, so going back to the dawn of reality TV, the very first season of Survivor, you have, what's his name?
Oh, so there was Richard and Kelly and Rudy were in the essentially the last immunity challenge. The result of the immunity challenge would be one of those players would get immunity. The other two votes would cancel out, and therefore the winner of the immunity challenge would essentially decide who would be eliminated, and the remaining two people would go on to the final round and have an opportunity in front of a jury of seven players to win $1 million.
So the shocking thing that happened during that episode was that one of the players, Rich, in the middle of the immunity challenge, which was, by today's standards, probably rather dull, but
pretty
at
tame,
the time,
yes.
It was very exciting.
It was
TV.
Very tense, yes.
It was three people putting their hand to an idol and standing on a log and seeing how long they could stand still for. Fascinating. And
great television folks.
And fantastic. And so Rich had one of the three had figured out, or basically had figured out that he could win the game by losing the challenge.
Right.
And shocked America when he jumped off of his log after like 25 minutes of waiting and just sat out and watched the rest of it play out.
Right, right.
Between the other two contestants.
So the authors of the book go into a very elaborate detail in terms of working out what Rich's game tree looked like. But I remember, to your point about simplification, in my mind, it was really this simple. It was Rich realized that if Rudy won the challenge, if Kelly won the challenge, generally speaking, the situation was Rudy was known to be popular with the jury. If Rudy went to the final with anybody, the jury was likely to pick Rudy. Nobody liked Kelly, right? So generally speaking, if Kelly won the immunity challenge, she would certainly vote off Rudy and face Rich at the final. So Rich would go to the final. Now, also in play here was that Rudy and Rich had an alliance, and Rudy was a very faithful player, or at least that was what Rich was gambling on, that Rudy would be true to the alliance. In which case, if Rudy won the immunity challenge, he would vote off Kelly, and Rich would go to the final. So essentially, with those two cases, Rich evaluated that there was a very, very good chance that in either case, he was going to the final round, and then he would just try to win the game there. And that's why he stepped off the log and relinquished the immunity challenge. And really made it difficult on the other two players. And he did, of course.
And he did, of course, win.
Yes.
And I think people were, if I can recall, because this was back in 2000, so it was a long time ago now, but I recall people were surprised that when faced with it, the Rudy character just held so strong to that alliance.
Yes.
Considering in all subsequent series, the alliances were so much harder to keep.
Yes, very, very true. The whole concept of an alliance in Survivor, it was very interesting how that emerged in some of the earlier episodes, because people were denying at tribal council that alliances even existed, mm-hmm. which was, I thought, really interesting later, especially in the context of later games, versions of the game. But it was not, if Rudy had done his game tree analysis, he would have voted Rich off and brought Kelly to the final and won the game.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like someone didn't do their game theory right.
That's right.
And they made a bad decision.
At that point, the first player had already made, Rich had just made the first move, and
right.
he really put the other two
right.
into a bind.
So as it turns out, Kelly actually won the immunity challenge. What happened is every so many minutes they would switch logs, I think, and during the course of a log switch, Rudy inadvertently took his hand off the idol. And Jeff Probst didn't even notice it. It was Kelly that noticed it and called him out on it, and they had it on camera, and so Rudy was eliminated.
Riveting television.
Riveting television.
It was a golden age.
A golden age,
don't,
right.
Don't make fun.
Hey, it's a board game. It is technically a board
it's
game.
It's a board game, right.
It's a dexterity game.
It's a dexterity game.
Oh, by the
game.
Way, the yeah. board game Survivor, not worth the paper it's printed on.
Well, you know, they can't print that big of a log with a golden idol to put your hand on.
Right.
So one of the things that would be interesting to talk about is just this idea of a game's needing a sufficient amount of complexity within their game.
Right.
Because if the only two things you can do for a sequential move game is randomization and complexity...
Don't forget timer.
And a timer. Well, we usually call that social pressure at the table.
True, yes.
Because I don't know how many times I just began my move and people are yelling at me to finish my move.
Right.
It's like, I just started. But so with faced with those three options, it seems like the difficulty in designing the game is making it of sufficient complexity.
Right.
Without being so complex, no one plays it.
Well, that's the other thing, right? And also without it being so complex that maybe there isn't some hidden degenerate strategy or a flaw in terms of, you know, there.
Or a Halifax hammer buried
right,
in
exactly.
there somewhere.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, it's a shame because what is generally regarded as a very good game really has kind of fallen into some disrepute because of it.
Clarify the game for everybody.
Sure. So the name of the game is A Few Acres of Snow. It uses something of a deck-building mechanic in a war game with a map and movement of troops and all that kind of thing. Very innovative and clever design. It was very, very popular for the first year that it came out until this Halifax Hammer strategy emerged where someone claimed, and I think it was validated, that I think the British mm-hmm. could win consistently by executing this unstoppable strategy.
Because at that point, your deck is so thin, you're always guaranteed the cards, and you could just continue to press forth
right.
down one specific path. And
the opponent has no means of preventing it, so yes.
Well, this hits on a challenge, because to create that level of complexity in the game, you know, if you're approaching the level of chess, it's really hard for you as the designer to use game theory to make sure they're isn't
right.
a solvable mm-hmm. strategy, because you're purposely trying to create one where you can't.
Exactly. So all you can do is hope that over the course of many, many playtests, you know, the law of numbers and averages and opportunities and so forth, that you will find those strategies or potential for those kinds of weaknesses early.
Well, you also want to see, are people developing various intermediate value functions? Are you seeing multiple approaches, or is it becoming predictable?
Right. Right. And then you get into what makes a game fun and interesting. If every game follows the same course, then it tends to be less interesting as a game, even if it's perfectly valid from a game theory standpoint.
And it's just an intermediate value function and not a we've solved the game. It's just we've solved the best intermediate value function.
Right.
Or are your players just doing the same thing over and over again because they don't understand any of the other possible
right.
branches they
right.
can take?
Right.
They want those wild, crazy ideas that they can't think of, but they're worried someone else is going to come up with because they can't do all the moves. Well, I think we're coming full circle here with this.
Right, have we learned anything here? Well, we've learned a lot, but...
Yeah, but it's one of those things where you ask yourself, so I need to make a game that's complex enough that we can't solve it, but that means if it's complex enough we can't solve it, I'm not sure if it actually works. Even if I play test it all the time, there could still be the Halifax hammer hidden somewhere in my game.
Right. The only reason, and we don't even know this with certainty, but I think the only reason we don't believe there is a Halifax hammer in chess is because after hundreds of years, it would have turned up by now. Hmm. Right? Except for the fact.
That's a non-factual, though. That's,
well, that's just it.
We prove it
that,
because it's
the
not
fact,
there.
We all also already know how many, many, many years it would take to run through all of the possible games of chess.
Go.
Yeah, go. Even more so.
No, this is my counter. I'm going to argue that Go is the counter to that statement. What's been the big takeaway from all the competition with Google's computer in Go? Go players have concluded that the computer has figured something out that is better than what everyone else currently has. At the very least, it has found a better intermediate value function, and it's forcing Go players to reassess strategy across the entire game. So that suggests to me that the game could very easily be broken. It's just we haven't found the right permutation yet.
Interesting.
But if your game's, okay, you have the chess solution. Your game's so complex, odds are no one will ever find it.
Right. So let's take one other example, a simpler example, checkers. The book goes into how checkers, well, I don't know, maybe that wasn't true at the first edition, but in July of 2007, it was proven that checkers perfectly played will always result in a draw.
First edition came out in 1999, so I'm pretty sure it's not the first edition.
Right.
Yes, checkers has been solved.
Right. So that means, I don't want to say that means there's no point in playing, but I will say it means that it is possible to sufficiently learn the game that will always result in a draw between two perfect players. It does explain why I remember hearing about a fellow who essentially never lost a game in many, many years. Clearly he had more closely identified that optimum game than anyone else.
So he had a bunch of wins, no losses, and a bunch of draws.
Probably a bunch of draws, yes.
Okay, so yes, this does come full circle. We are at Unpub. That this is a very big lesson as to why you need to prototype your games.
Right.
You need to get people to play your games so that they might find something that you haven't found.
Right.
And even if you play tested hundreds of thousands of times, if your game's enough permutations, if your game sells enough copies, I wouldn't be completely surprised if someone breaks it. And don't feel too bad.
Yeah.
I mean, feel bad you didn't play tested enough, sure, but at some point, if there's enough permutations in your game.
Right. It certainly explains why collectible card games like Magic the Gathering, which come up with many, many permutations of cards, invariably end up finding breakages in tournament competition.
Right. And then they have to retcon a card. They have to remove cards from tournament plays. But it also gets, there also becomes this slightly larger metaphysical question, though, is that if we are creating games, and we know that most of these games have the ability to be solved, why do we want to keep playing these games?
We haven't solved them yet.
So solving them is the fun. Or pursuing the solution is the fun.
There are definitely players out there that take pride in solving a game.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Solving people's prototypes. Maybe someone named Michael and Keller. We love you, Michael. Please solve our games so you solve them before someone else does when we're trying to sell them. That is a challenge in itself. And I'm sure Michael, I know I would take great pride in saying, that's broken. That doesn't work.
I'm not going to name names, but there is a game here that I do have to check in on because the last time I played it in an earlier prototype, after finishing the game, I had figured out how to solve the game, break the game, and I want to see if they actually solved the loophole that I told them about. And if not, then, play the game and beat it.
I'm secretly worrying whether it's my game.
No, it's not your game. It's a different game. It's not your game. I shall remain nameless because, because it can always get better. Games
sure.
Your game can always get better.
And we're breaking them for a reason. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you guys for coming here today. It's been a great discussion. We look forward to having you guys hear us as we talk about chapter... Well, chapter, I shouldn't say chapter.
Well,
we go by title.
That's a good question, because right now the next thing that we have is, in my book, second edition, is chapter 4, Simultaneous Move Games with Pure Strategies 1, Discrete Strategies.
Okay, our titles are starting to diverge.
Yes, things are starting to change between the years.
So my chapter 4 is the same as Austin's. Simultaneous Move Games with Pure Strategies 1, Discrete Strategies.
Okay.
So I'm the one that's going to be at the disadvantage. But for those of you who are reading along, you have the old edition, just read chapter 4. You have the newer editions, read chapter 4. But any case, we're starting simultaneous moves, and we look forward to talking more about that and how this is going to help us be better game designers, or at least understand what's going on. If you want to know more about either of us, you can... go to drwitz.com, or you can follow Dr. Witz on Twitter at DrWitz. You can also follow Paul Owen. He has a blog called Man Overboard. I suggest you look at Paul Owen Man Overboard so you don't mix it up with something else. You can also follow Paul on Twitter at Paul Owen Games.
Thank you, everybody, and have a good night.